Back with you, a busy show on Friday, February 5th, 2021, wrapping up a busy week on Connecticut Today. We welcomed author Amelia Pang in the 3 o'clock hour. Her new book targets forced slave labor and prison labor in China that often makes products you and I buy at many major retailers. Tax specialist Patrick Hedger joined us in the 4 o'clock hour to talk about tax policy and maybe upcoming minimum wage hikes under the Biden White House. And in the 5 o'clock hour, we wrapped it up with Carol Hughes. He heads the Connecticut Package Store Association. He talked about his association's opposition to a bill that would let many major supermarkets in the state carry wine. Welcome the author of that book. It's an amazing topic and something right out of a movie screen, I think, but it rings all too true. The name of the book is Made in China, A Prisoner in SOS Letter and the Hidden Cost of America's Cheap Goods. It is a fascinating story. Author Amelia Pang joins us. She's an award-winning journalist who's written for publications like The New Republic on Mother Jones, covering topics ranging from organic import fraud to the prevalence of sexual violence in Native American reservations. Amelia, hi. It's Paul at WICC in Bridgeport. Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me, Paul.
Well, thank you. And I saw the background of this book, and this is, I want to say amazing, but it's a chilling story in some ways. And it all begins, as you note in the title of the book, Amelia, it begins with a note that somebody found in something they bought at a big box store. Talk about that.
Yes, the story is about an American woman named Julie Keith. She's this ordinary suburban mom of two kids, and she opens up this brand new package of Halloween decorations from Kmart one day as she's preparing to plan a Halloween party for her kids, and out falls an SOS letter written by the political prisoner who had made and packaged this product in a labor camp in China. And so the book tells his story, how he landed in a labor camp, what became of him. And it also steps back to look at the problems in our supply chain and the really flawed ways that a lot of companies are auditing their Chinese suppliers and what we as consumers can do about it.
So many of us, Amelia, would be in the store. We'd pick that up. We'd take that home for our kids. We'd see that note and say, well, whatever. Yeah, this is a prank or whatever. I don't want to get mixed up in this. And I would say, Amelia, I might be wrong, but I would say a lot of people would just say, you know, la, 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 don't see this, crumble it up and, you know, throw it in the trash can. Okay, let's have mommy put up the decorations. How did this advance in this story, Amelia, advance from this woman who saw this note?
I mean, yes, she wondered if it was a hoax. I mean, I think many of us would if we find such a shocking note. But unfortunately, she actually did make a lot of effort to get help for this poor man. But unfortunately, it wasn't a hoax. And, you know, it wasn't the first letter of this kind to be found, and it wasn't the last. There are, unfortunately, China has the largest forced labor system in existence in the world today. There's just in the Muslim labor camps alone for the Uyghurs and other Turkic minorities, there are anywhere between 1.5 to 3 million people in those camps. And that is just a camp that's targeting one demographic. There's many, many different kinds of camps throughout China with innocuous names such as pretrial detention centers and drug detox centers. But they are all detaining people arbitrarily without a trial, without access to lawyers. And they all have to do manufacturing work for around 15 to 20 hours a day, typically. They experience torture. They're starved. They don't have access to medical care. And if the company really needs them to meet a specific production deadline, they could even be forced to stay up 24 hours straight working in some cases. These are really, really grueling conditions. And a lot of these are political dissidents. And they're making cheap products that end up selling in our stores. Mm.
The name of the book is Made in China, A Prisoner, an SOS Letter, and the Hidden Cost of America's Cheap Goods. Amelia Pang is the guest. It came out this past Tuesday. Amelia, hang on. We'll be right back to you. Got to do a little business here. We'll get more into this forced labor and these labor camps and America's lust for cheap items. Amelia Pang is the guest. Back to her momentarily. First, traffic and weather together at 3:36 on WICC. Name of the book is Made in China, A Prisoner, an SOS Letter, and the Hidden Cost of America's Cheap Goods. Amelia Pang is the author. You can pick it up wherever you get your books, Amazon, your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble. It came out this past Tuesday. The accolades for this are far and wide. Very, very good. Amelia, continuing. So the gentleman who wrote this letter, actually, or this note that was eventually found by this Oregon mom and start of this tumbleweed of events leading up to your book here. This gentleman was actually an engineer at one time in China, you say, and his activities in a meditation movement ended him up in one of these forced labor situations.
Right. That's unfortunately a very common situation. A lot of the people who end up in these camps are political dissidents, religious dissidents, they are Falun Gong followers, which is the banned meditation group. They are underground Christians who don't want to go to a state-sanctioned church where they're not really allowed to practice their faith fully. There's also a lot of pro-democracy activists, Tibetans, Uyghurs, other ethnic minority groups. Civil rights lawyers who try to defend these people, you know, it's and there's a lot of petty criminals as well, mm-hmm. who don't necessarily deserve that. The crime doesn't fit the punishment.
So, you know, Amelia, you and I both know this. My listeners know this. The world probably knows this. You know, this is no secret. I mean, this has been going on. This has been talked about for years and years and years. I'm sure the big retailers know this. Their suppliers know this. So is there just a fear to confront this? Because as I've said before in the past here on my programs over the years, Amelia, a lot of times people don't care about this if they can get something cheap, $1 cheaper than the next store. They tend to plug their ears about this. Is that the problem we have around the world maybe in confronting all this?
That's part of the problem, the cheapness of the price, but it's not the only problem. Expensive brands have been implicated in using forced mm-hmm. labor as well. For example, last year, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute released a very well-researched report that found 82 major global brands using Uyghur forced laborers in China. And that included big brands like BMW, Mercedes-Benz, Nike, Abercrombie & Fitch, Ralph Lauren. These are not cheap dollar store shops. You know, these are companies that do charge a hefty price for their products, and consumers should start asking, we want to know how our product is actually made if we're paying such high prices for them.
So are any of these companies, Amelia, are they confronted on this? Are there any groups? Are there any people that confront them and say, hey, you know this is going on, don't you? You can't plead ignorant on this. Or do they try and plead ignorance? Or is it a case of, hey, this is how the world operates. It's the Chinese Communist Party. What can we do? What's the reaction when they're, if at all, confronted on this?
I think when you have a lot of consumers confronting them, it is very impactful. For example, in the 90s, you know, Nike was facing a lot of criticism for using sweatshops, and that kind of consumer-led mass protest really led to the creation of audits. Now it's standard for companies to audit their factories, and that was unprecedented before all the news came out about the sweatshops and all the outrage that consumers experienced in the 90s. So that was really a positive step in a good direction, but it didn't quite go far enough because, as my book details, there's a lot of problem with the audits, and they can't really detect forced labor a lot of the times.
What has been...
Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead. No, please finish. Go ahead.
So I think, you know, consumer protests can really have an impact, and we need to start up that kind of a movement again and really push our companies to drop suppliers if there's evidence that forced labor was used in the process.
Does the Chinese Communist Party and the people who run these operations for them, do they admit what's going on? Do they out and out lie, or do they say, "Well, this is what we do. This is our country. This is part of our economy. If you don't like it, then don't do business with us." How do they respond to the allegations?
They say that no such thing is happening. But it is. I went to China, and I went to the labor camps, and I talked to the guards and confirmed there were prisoners manufacturing products inside. And I sat outside and I followed the trucks that left these camps to see exactly which exporters they were working with. And they were working with all kinds of exporters, from pharmaceuticals to school supplies factories, to another factory that made pet products. You know, it was just such a wide range of factories. And when you look at the customs records, it shows that most of them are exporting to the U.S. and all around the world.
Were you at any time afraid for your personal safety doing this? You know, we all know what the Chinese Communist Party can do to those who snoop around a little too much or don't, you know, toe the party line. Were you fearing for your safety at any time researching this in China?
I was nervous, but I figured the worst thing that would probably happen to someone like me, you know, I was born in the U.S. I've never been a Chinese national, even though I am of Chinese descent.
Yeah.
So you know, you do have a lot more protections if you're technically a foreigner in China, especially for journalists. If you're a Chinese national reporting on this, you could get into serious trouble and go to prison for years, maybe even potentially get executed. But for foreign journalists, while they'll try to give you a hard time about it, they'll like try to stop you and detain you to prevent you from getting any reporting done, but they are unlikely to actually imprison you for years at a time or anything like that.
Are you making sure copies of this maybe get to the powerful in D.C. and some of these companies? Will there be a push by you and your publisher to make sure that people know this book is out there?
I gave an interview on C-SPAN, and I hope that will lead to an impact. But I think ultimately the rich and the powerful may not actually act on this unless there's actually a push for them to do so based on their voters or the consumers who shop from these brands. So it's still ultimately up to people like us to really create a change in our consumption culture.
The name of the book is called Made in China, A Prisoner, an SOS Letter, and the Hidden Cost of America's Cheap Goods. The guest has been Amelia Pang. Check out the book. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the places you can buy it, even at your local bookstore. Why not do that? Amelia, good luck with you and the book, and hopefully we can chat in the future. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Thanks, Amelia. Bye-bye. Made in China, A Prisoner, an SOS Letter, and the Hidden Cost of America's Cheap Goods. Folks, that's it. Joining us is a gentleman to talk about the proposal to raise the national minimum wage, the federal minimum wage, raise the floor to $15 an hour eventually. Now, we get word that the COVID-19 stimulus package that's probably going to pass is probably going to pass, partly because it does not have that minimum wage hike in it, but we'll talk about that and more. And the guest, he is the VP of Policy at the Taxpayers Protection Alliance, is Patrick Hedger, who joins us right now on WICC. Patrick, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. And Patrick, do you hear what I hear that and read, that the $15 eventual hike to the minimum wage has now been pulled out of that bill?
Yeah, that's what we're hearing. So it looks like we've dodged that bullet for now. But you know, just the fact that we were even considering this in one of the worst economies I hope to ever live through is just ludicrous.
Patrick, when I was first working, and I'm sure you've heard this from a bunch of people, and maybe you first were working in, you know, in your job in college or in high school, The minimum wage for most of the history of this country was a training wage. It was something there to let young people, young guys and gals, learn the value of money, start a bank account, save gas money so you weren't bothering dad all the time, maybe buy a used car when you're a senior in high school or whatever. But now over the past couple of years, Patrick, through maybe no fault of other people in their life situations, there's been a push to make it high enough to actually raise a family on or maintain a family. I think that's one of the biggest problems we have here if you bore down into this issue.
Yeah, there's a total misconception about who's making minimum wage or, as you said, what it's designed for, right? The minimum wage is about keeping the risk low for businesses to bring on unskilled, untested, unproven workers, right? People are a big liability. I mean, so if any business's biggest liability is their staff, right? People, they lie, they cheat, they steal. But, you know, if you don't know somebody and they come in and they cause, you know, you don't want to assume a huge risk for your business. And so lowering the cost of bringing somebody in without proven skills or a proven track record gives you a greater incentive to do that, which helps those people build the necessary skills, the trust, the resume, if you will, for them to go on to command higher wages for the rest of their career. And when we're looking at who makes the minimum wage, we're talking about a very small percentage of the workforce that's at or near the minimum wage. There's no law forcing employers to pay people more than the minimum wage, but yet somewhere north of 95 to 97% of the population makes more than the minimum wage, which tells you employers reward skills, which people need to, as I said, be able to gain and get on the job training.
What about the argument, though, from some, Patrick, that, you know what, people don't necessarily, at least adults or those with families, they don't want to take minimum wage jobs, but it may be the last resort because of a layoff or a sickness or whatever life dealt them. What do you say to the critics who say maybe the minimum wage should be high enough that someone doesn't have to miss a car or a rent payment?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I would love for us to be able to snap our fingers and make everybody be able to command higher wages than what the current minimum wage is. But the only trade-off that you're going to get by raising the cost of employing somebody is less employment. That's it. I mean, why are we applying the same economics that we're using to get people to stop smoking cigarettes to the labor market, right? We raise the cost of a pack of cigarettes to hope to dissuade people from smoking. And that seems to have worked for the most part, right? Smoking rates are way down. So why would we raise the cost of hiring somebody, right? All that does is create a disincentive. All it does is either lower benefits. It's going to reduce hours. It's going to reduce the total number of people in the workforce. And it also causes a shift of people that are making that higher wage and a more difficult job to take on those lower skilled jobs because they can make the same amount of money as they were before. So there's all sorts of perverse incentives. This money just doesn't come out of thin air.
Now, the federal government has run some numbers on this. We'll come back with Patrick and talk about that. The guest is Patrick Hedger. He's the VP of Policy at the Taxpayers Protection Alliance, talking about what raising the minimum wage nationally, some states have already done it, but nationally over some years to $15 an hour, what that would do down the road for jobs lost, some numbers out of Congress. We'll talk about that straight ahead. First, though, traffic and weather together. Patrick, hang on, back to you. It's a 436 at WICC. Patrick Hedger is the Vice President of Policy at the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. Check him out online, protectingtaxpayers.org, protectingtaxpayers.org. And Patrick, before we get into some of these government numbers on the minimum wage, talk a little about your organization. What do you folks do there?
Yeah, absolutely. As the name implies, we're the Taxpayers Protection Alliance, and we're a taxpayer watchdog and consumer watchdog. So we are trying to give voice to the you know, the average American worker or family that doesn't have a voice in Washington or is too busy trying to keep food on their table to worry about what's going on in D.C. We just advocate for an approach that of limited government, free markets, and free enterprise, which is what's generated all the prosperity that we enjoy in America today.
You would send out some numbers, Patrick, regarding a possible raising of the federal minimum wage eventually to $15 an hour over a set of years that came from the Congressional Budget Office. What did the CBO say?
Yeah, the CBO says, I mean, and this is, again, a pretty conservative estimate. The CBO is generally pretty conservative in its cost estimates. Well north of 1 million jobs, I believe it's 1.3 million jobs would be eliminated by raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. People have to remember that nationwide, the federal minimum wage is $7.25. So we're talking about a doubling in the minimum wage. And we also have to remember that a dollar does not have the same purchasing power across this huge, great country of ours. In terms of purchasing power, a $15 minimum wage actually translates into something north of $60 per hour in Puerto Rico, right? Which no business there is going to be able to afford. Some states have been able to raise the minimum wage to that level without having the major scene effects that you would see nationwide. But it's the poorer states, the poorer territories who we're apparently trying to help that would really, really take it on the chin from this.
And we're seeing, Patrick, I talked about this earlier in the show, you and I see the stories popping up. Hey, McDonald's is trying automation here, Kmart, Walmart, Popeyes, all the places that would employ minimum wage folks. You see the automated kiosks, the mechanical cooking systems. I mean, these companies know what's coming down the road. They're not dumb.
No, not at all. And they're already adapting to it. And if you really think about it, right, there's a high upfront cost for capital like that, right? The machines, the automation. But over time, those machines tend to be more reliable, right? They don't get sick, right? They don't take vacation. The machine is just there and it needs upkeep and repair. And if you start bringing the cost of labor up to parity with the cost of the lifetime of employing that machine, employers are going to employ that machine because, the machine doesn't need an HR department. There's a lot of associated costs with employing people. And so, just this idea that you're going to be able to magically raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, I mean, why not 16? Why not 17? This number came out of thin air.
And it's interesting, Patrick, that if people check, and I've always said they should do this, there are a lot of very high standard of living countries around the world, currently, of course, living in this century, that don't have minimum wage laws. It's fascinating that some of these countries don't, and they just rely on the market to set kind of a low end for what a wage would be. I've always wondered, Patrick, if that would ever work out in this country. If ABC Hamburger Joint doesn't get anybody to come to work for them for $4 an hour, they're going to have to pay more.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's why in some places where you've seen the minimum wage raised to, $15 an hour, it didn't have huge ripple effects because that was already the natural market wage. So that's happening not just overseas, which you're right about, but it's happening here in the United States. And what we also have to consider when we look at those countries in Europe, those are very high tax countries as well. So people and the tax levels are a lot more evenly distributed over there, right? So here in the U.S., we actually have a very progressive tax system. For the most part, it's the rich that are paying the vast majority of the taxes, even with the tax cuts in place. In Europe, you have a much more equitable tax system, proportional tax system. And so the people that are making those huge wages for the low-skilled jobs actually don't see as much take-home pay as a minimum wage worker here in the U.S.
Yeah. Speaking of your organization's mission and taxes, before we let you go, Patrick, what are you hearing from the Hill and maybe contacts with the new administration? I'm reading both left and right all kinds of projections as to what the Biden White House might do to roll back some of the Trump tax policies, but there may be a political cost with that. I know we're only a few weeks in, but anything you see in your crystal ball on that?
Yeah, so there's a huge, long Biden wish list. I'm sure they want to raise the corporate tax rate. I think that's probably their number one goal. And also they want to reinstitute the SALT deduction, which is generally favors pretty rich blue states. But what's really going to be difficult is getting anything across the desk of Joe Manchin. With a 50-50 Senate, Joe Manchin and to a certain extent Kristen Sinema, some of these very moderate Democrats they're not going to do anything too radical to rock the boat. So I would keep an eye on what their offices are saying, and that'll give you a good sense really throughout the first 2 years of the Biden administration what's going to be possible. So close eye on, again, Joe Manchin, West Virginia, Kristen Sinema in Arizona.
Boy, Joe Manchin, suddenly maybe, Patrick, the most powerful guy in D.C., honestly. He might be.
Yeah, no, you're not exaggerating about that. He really is. Joe Manchin sort of single-handedly holds the power to veto any sort of legislation that comes through the Senate.
Check it out, folks. ProtectingTaxpayers.org is the website, ProtectingTaxpayers.org. It's the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. VP of Policy Patrick Hedger has joined us. Patrick, thank you. Have a great weekend. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right. Patrick Hedger, VP of Policy, the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. Check them out, protectingtaxpayers.org. Stores, we talked about this yesterday. There was a hearing held earlier this week. A bill that was first up in 2019 has popped up again that would allow some of these, if you will, big box grocers, the big grocery stores, allow them to expand their alcohol offerings to include wine. Well, one group doesn't like that. The Connecticut Package Store Association, the head of that group, Carol Hughes, joins us right now on WICC. Carol, how are you, sir?
Good, Paul. Thanks for having me today.
Where did this come from again, Carol? It popped up a couple of years ago, and it popped up again in a hearing this week. I know you were very to the point about opposing this and your group, but why does this keep coming up? Who's pushing this?
You know, it's actually coming from one state representative, but behind him, it's the major food stores and the farm wineries, to a certain extent, think they're going to do better if they're in a supermarket, mm-hmm. Which is really not quite clear that they are going to do that. And we currently sell all of their wines in package stores.
So the idea here, I guess, Carol, is a wink-wink to get people. Just their theory is what? If these are the big stores, more people are going to go there, so we'll push more product. I mean, I don't mean to go beyond my limits here, but is that what they're saying, essentially?
Yeah, essentially what does happen is the wines get displaced. There's only so much alcohol which is sold. It's finite. You don't sell any more wine because it's cheaper or whether it's more available in more places. You don't sell any more spirits or beer or whatever. There's just a certain market for it, and it's pretty consistent across the country. So if somebody is selling it in the supermarket and their customer count on a weekend is up around 10 times what a package store is, some people will just pick up wine there, maybe not the same quality. Very few people there to tell them if it's any good or not or answer their questions, but they'll pick up something and it displaces the good wine and the quality operations that my package stores run.
Now, a lot of people would hear the term liquor store, package store, and say, oh, there's not a lot of those left. Oh, come on, it's the year 2021. To what extent, Carol, in Connecticut, are we talking about numbers of employees and establishments that call themselves, you know, liquor stores or package stores? What are the numbers?
There's actually 1,250 of them in Connecticut right now, and they employ 15,000 people, full-time, part-time, and they're one of the last stores left on Main Street. They and the restaurants are going quickly, and we don't want the package stores to go the same way. And it's incredible that somebody would be proposing this type of legislation in an economic crisis, a public health pandemic. It's like, what don't we want to help people with? And we're taking the money from the smaller stores and we're giving it to the major grocery store chains, Kmart, Walmart. It sounds like they're hurting or something, you know?
Yeah, and again, you know, Carol, I look at, and I've said this before, I'm not a wine drinker, not a big alcohol drinker, but, you know, I look at the package stores and the liquor stores in the neighborhoods, and I drive by a good number of them in and around where I live and other parts of the state. To me, they're almost like of the old-fashioned or the old camera store where, yeah, you could buy that camera anywhere if you searched, but to me, Carol, I think it's a dying breed, hopefully not dying, but, you know, you have that person that maybe knows what you drink. You can always pick that person's brain if you're serving a certain dinner, what goes with it. I don't think you're going to get that, with all due respect to the big grocery stores, I don't think you're going to get that there.
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, if you add, we think it adds in as many as 2,000 new outlets in addition to the 1,250 package stores. And who's going to pay for that? Who's going to pay for the deliveries? The wholesalers get increased costs, and they pass it on the cost of the product. And currently, we have one of the finest markets in the country in Connecticut. We have like 130 wholesalers that bring in specialty products from almost every country in the world. They bring in specially small batches of wine and items from wineries that are in all parts of the world. And that all goes away once you're just dealing with price and you're in a cutthroat competition. And the Connecticut wines probably were one of the first ones to suffer because they just are not going to be pushed by the giant food stores. They're into slotting fees. They do all kinds of tie-in deals, and that's the problem.
Well, and I mentioned this yesterday, knowing you were going to come on, Carol. You know, my family was in the grocery business, my extended family, my immediate family. Yeah. And I think you just alluded to it. It's all about shelf space. I mean, people, they think square footage is big in these stores. But no, there's only so many shelves you could put up. And this is when the cannibalizing begins about how many bottles, how many packages these big box stores can, you know, hold over the heads of these manufacturers of wine as far as shelf space goes. It's a commodity to them.
Right. And we'd probably lose about 6,000 employees in the package stores, and none of those are going to a food store. They don't hire people. The poor cashiers that used to be there, it's now a cash register farm. You do it self-service. You pick up your food self-service. There's nobody working those grocery aisles. You know, if you find somebody stocking a shelf, it's usually a root salesman. And if you go up to him and ask him where the anchovies are, he'll tell you in about three different languages that he doesn't work there, you know?
And I feel sorry, Carol, for some of the people who are real wine lovers. I mean, a lot of people who don't drink wine say, yeah, wine, whatever. But I have friends, and I'm sure you do too, who are really passionate about this stuff and look at certain times of the year when certain things are coming out and they go out and stock up. I mean, wine connoisseurs who go to these to go to your member stores are really serious about a lot of this.
Even the average person wants decent stuff. He wants to know what's going on in the store. He's not going to find that quality. I went out to Arizona once. And I went to the store, and there's a young kid who was in, obviously, the wine department. I went up, and I asked him. I said, he had this kind of wine, this brand, whatever.
Yeah.
And he just repeats me. He said, no, we have red, white, and rosy. So I said, well, is rosy working today? You know?
Red, white, and rosy. So, that's great. That's great. Carol, listen, does this thing really have any legs, or is there enough opposition that this thing will either be voted down or won't come out of committee? What do you think?
Well, you know, we've been in a few issues so far with COVID-19. Mm-hmm. The problem is there's a certain detachment of legislators from each other and a certain detachment from legislators to lobbyists that talk to them all the time.
Yeah.
So people can take advantage of that situation. So that's problematic. Fortunately, I have a lot of members statewide, and they're pretty active people, but it's not as certain as it could be because some chairpersons have very significant influence over the committee and over their members. And so it's an uncertain future. I think it's crazy that you would think that we would take all this money from the small people, put these immigrants, basically a lot of them, over half the stores are owned by people who have been here probably less than 10 or 15 years in the country, and take these people and put them out of business. And then what do we do next year? Create a program to help them, you know, and spend state money? I hope not.
Carol Hughes heads the Connecticut Package Store Association. Carol, thank you. We'll keep in touch with you on this, and have a good weekend. We appreciate the time. Paul, thanks.
Paul, it's after 5 o'clock, and I think I'm going to the wine shop. Okay, see ya.
Thanks, Carol. Appreciate it. Carol Hughes there heads the Connecticut Package Store Association. What's that song? It's a country song or something. It's 5 o'clock. That's it. My producer told me, yes, it's 5 o'clock summer. Yes, it is.